Today is Thursday, September 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump says there are many options to respond to Iranian attacks on Saudi oil fields.
If we have to do something, we'll do it without hesitation.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's fate remains in limbo with an election still too close to call. Also ahead, Nicki Minaj coming out of retirement after two whole weeks. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Wednesday called the attack on Saudi Arabia's oil installations an act of war against the kingdom by Iran. The Saudis displayed missile and drone wreckage and cited other evidence they said shows the raid was unquestionably sponsored by Iran.
Were that true? It's not, but were that true? It doesn't change the fingerprints of the Ayatollah as having put at risk the global energy supply.
That he is referring to the Houthi rebels in Yemen claiming responsibility for the attack. Iran has denied involvement and warned the U.S. it will retaliate immediately if it's targeted. President Donald Trump, meanwhile, said he's moving to increase financial sanctions on Tehran over the attack, but he was noncommittal on whether he would order U.S. military retaliation.
There's the ultimate option, and there are options a lot less than that. And we'll see. We're in a very powerful position. Right now, we're in a very, very powerful position.
You say the ultimate option. Are you talking
No, I'm saying the ultimate option, meaning go in war. No, I'm not talking about that ultimate option, no.
At a news conference, Saudi military spokesman Colonel Tuki al-Malki said the attack Saturday that did heavy damage to the heart of the Saudi oil industry was launched from the north and was unquestionably sponsored by Iran. Yemen is south of Saudi Arabia, while Iran and Iraq lie to the north. Yemen's Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, as we said, claimed responsibility, saying it was in response to the Saudi-led war in Yemen that has killed tens of thousands of people. Joining us now to talk more about it is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. The U.S. certainly clear on who they believe it is who is responsible.
The language pinning this on Iran is actually rather ambiguous. It's quite clear that the rebels don't have the wherewithal to do this. I think everybody's in agreement on that. So who could it be? Who reasonably could it be? It could be Turkey. It could be Russia. And it could be Israel, all of which have an argument. I mean, one can find a reason for their doing so.
Why would Israel want to do something like that?
I don't know that it would. What I'm suggesting is it does have a motivation. Israel's been concerned about Mr. Trump meeting with the president of Iran, and that, you know, it's certainly that's not in its interest from the way it perceives powers in the Middle East. Israel and Russia, for each of them, you can think up a plausible reason why they would be interested in this attack. It's not like I have any insider information. But what I am suggesting is that the language that leaders have used with respect to Iran tends to be quite dodgy.
Don't you think they probably know by now with the information they're able to get?
One would think. The U.S., of course, has satellite imagery which would show cruise missiles. Might actually show drones. But we've got all kinds of intelligence assets in the Middle East, U.S. assets in the Middle East. So I would think they would know.
Well, the president did come out and say he is substantially increasing economic sanctions against Iran in the wake of this situation. They've already been hammered with sanctions already. Is that the kind of thing that you would want to go to your allies with first to get the support?
Well, it seems to me that if you're persuaded that Iran did this, that sanctions are not the way to respond. This is, as Secretary Pompeo said, this is an act of war. You don't go bombing a foreign country and call it anything other than an act of war. And for acts of war, you don't put in sanctions. When the U.S. entered World War II, it didn't say, okay, we're going to stop buying German products. I mean, that's ridiculous. So it seems to me that if they were utterly persuaded that this was Iran, they would have used some sort of military response of some flavor.
This was not an attack on the United States. It was an attack on Saudi Arabia. Would that be up to Saudi Arabia to respond and the U.S. to support them? We certainly provide them with weapons.
Yes, we do. The problem is it's very hard to say that we don't have interest there. The Middle East has been a hot spot for, you know, as long as you and I have been alive. And it's very difficult to simply say, well, let Saudis take care of it.
Why?
Because I don't think they have the generalship, the military skill, and so forth. And yes, we provide them weapons, but I think what we would end up doing if there were a military response would be to provide intelligence and some strategic and tactical advice.
Well, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani certainly is coming out pretty strongly with warnings to Saudi Arabia over its involvement in leading any sort of...
But look, Iran likes to play the bully, and, you know, and it is big and powerful, but ultimately it doesn't want... I mean, look, to some degree, I think Iran, this is, of course, speculation, but I think Iran probably feels that it's kind of on the defensive, that it's encircled. The sanctions have really bitten into the economy of Iran. In order to, you know, this could all go away with regime change, but no leader ever commits suicide that way.
Well, do you think that ultimately this is headed toward a war of some sort?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think there's enough sanity on both sides to avoid that.
If there is no response, particularly after, you know, Iran shot down a U.S. drone and really nothing didn't face any consequences, would that be just basically giving them carte blanche to do as they wish because the U.S. or others would not?
Yes, but I just have a hard time imagining that if there is dispositive information that these, you know, either, for example, that the drones or the cruise missiles were manufactured by Iran, or we know how they got them. If there's dispositive information that way, I think a non-response is almost unthinkable.
All right, that is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. An official, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says the Israeli leader will not be attending this year's United Nations General Assembly in New York, an event that he ordinarily does use to advance Israeli interests on the world stage. The trip's cancellation comes just hours after Israel's national elections, in which Netanyahu failed to secure an outright victory in the polls, paving the way for arduous coalition talks. AP correspondent Aaron Heller reports that while results from Israel's unprecedented repeat election remain uncertain, it is clear the election did not go Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's way.
You can already say that Netanyahu did not win, and that was what he is expected to have happened sort of in the last several elections. He's won them. He's been in power for over 10 years. And this time he does not have an outright victory, and he's going to need a lot of machinations and a lot of things to go his way for him to be able to hang on to power.
Well, joining us now to talk more about the implications of Netanyahu's potential loss is American Jewish Committee Chief Policy and Political Affairs Officer Jason Isaacson. What do you make of what's happening so far with this basically election in limbo?
It's going to take some time before we know the final outcome. And then there's the count, and then there's the formation of a government, which is a whole separate process. When you have a process in which many parties are competing, and no one party ever has a majority, and you have to form a coalition government. Mm-hmm. The creation of these coalitions is a very intricate dance. We've went through this before in April, when a similarly split result left the prime minister to try to cobble together a government, was not able to gather the 61 seats in a 120-seat Knesset in order to form a government, and they had a new election, and that's what we've just gone through. So there will now be the process of assembling coalitions. The president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, will ask one of the leaders of one of the two major parties to perform that magic, and whether it'll be possible in the space of a few days or a few weeks or even longer than that to put together a government, we'll just have to see how that turns out. turns out. As it turns out, we do have roughly equal numbers of supporters, of votes, for those two parties. And whether they can, either of them, attract enough other parties, enough other factions within the very complicated political system of Israel to form that government remains to be seen. We will know over the coming weeks.
The strategy that Benjamin Netanyahu has taken, where he's talked about annexing the West Bank, the proposals he has put forward and to his base and his supporters would seem to potentially end any chance for a two-state solution. How would that work with building a coalition with people that feel the exact opposite?
I'm not sure that they feel the exact opposite, and I think that it would be a mistake to look at this election as a referendum on a two-state solution. There were really many issues that Israeli voters faced this week, and again in April, in the first go-around, that have to do with, frankly, a referendum on the prime minister, on the longevity of the longest-serving Israeli prime minister. There are corruption charges, as you know, that are floating around. He may be put to trial. There are questions about the nature of Israel, the religious versus secular divide that is very much a part of the current Israeli political conversation, cultural conversation. Relations with the Palestinians is part of that mix, but it's only one of many issues. Also, the economy of Israel, which has been growing, expanding, booming for years, to the point where it really is at or above, frankly, much of the OECD. But there are disparities. There are inequities within
right.
Israel, as there are in most countries. And that's also can be a driving political force. So there are many issues. It wasn't just about Israeli-Palestinian questions. It wasn't just about a two-state solution. It's possible to find, both in the sort of center-right and in the center-left, advocates for some kind of accommodation with the Palestinians. Certainly that has been a significant measure of, or rather a significant point for many Israelis. A majority of Israelis over the years have wanted a resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a negotiated resolution. And I think you could find within the center-right and the center-left some agreement on ways to move forward, and whether that would be separation plan of some sort that would put a halt to some of the kind of outlying settlement expansion that has taken place in recent years. That's all within the realm of possibility. But let me come back to one point that you made a moment ago, Laurie, about the relations between Israel and the Arab world, because, of course, the Arab world is so much larger than the relationship that Israel has with the Palestinians.
Right.
It's a fraught relationship and is a paralyzed relationship and needs to find some way of moving forward for the good of both peoples. But Israel's relations with the wider Arab world have undergone a very significant change in recent years. Not only, of course, for 25 years have we had peace between Israel and Jordan, and for 40 years peace between Israel and Egypt, but in recent years, and especially in the last year or two, you've seen signs of real change in relations between Israel and Gulf states. You had the prime minister in Oman last October. You had Israeli ministers going to the UAE last fall, one for a sports tournament, one for an international conference. You've had some indications from Bahrain, from other countries that recognize that Israel's part of the neighborhood. Arab Israelis, who are 20 or 21% of the overall population, turned out to vote in higher numbers than they did in April. In the last election, in April, some 49% of Arab Israelis voted. This time it was closer to 60%. They will have some 12 seats, as it seems right now, in the 120-seat Knesset. They could have more if they voted in higher numbers, but it's not insignificant, and it could be a factor in an Israeli government going forward. Probably not as a member of the Israeli government, but playing some sort of role which would be appropriate in Israeli politics.
What if Benjamin Netanyahu falls behind and does not get a role in any of this? What happens? That would be quite the end of an era.
He is the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history by, at this point, a few months over David Ben-Gurion. And yes, it would be an end of an era. I can't say that this election was good news for Prime Minister Netanyahu, nor can one say it's bad news. This is the nature of Israel's robust democracy, which, by the way, one must say, for 70 years has been a singular example of democracy in a very complicated region, under great challenges through wars and enormous changes internally in Israel, with millions of immigrants coming in from many parts of the world, including at least a million from the former Soviet Union, changing entirely the demographics of the state, not to mention the Jews from the Arab lands who came to Israel at various points since 1948, and now constitute a very significant portion of the Israeli electorate, not to mention the 20 or 21% of the population that is Arab as well. So through all of that, Israeli democracy has survived and has been an example, really a beacon in that region.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for being with us. That's American Jewish Committee Chief Policy and Political Affairs Officer Jason Isaacson. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump makes his mark on the signature border wall project. Rights groups are urging the release of journalists in Eritrea years after their disappearances. A lawsuit by relatives of the 9/11 victims shakes loose the name of a Saudi mystery man. And Vietnam, the fastest growing carbon polluter, is urged to shift cargo from land to water. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A young advocate for climate change was back on Capitol Hill for a second straight day. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
My name is Greta Thunberg.
The 16-year-old from Sweden told a House committee she didn't want to use her time to talk about the results of a report on global warming.
I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. And I want you to unite behind the science.
Thunberg has staged weekly demonstrations calling for world leaders to step up their efforts against climate change. While in Washington, she met with former President Barack Obama.
You and me were a team, huh?
Yes.
Do you know about fist bumping? Do you believe in fist bumping?
Yes.
You can do the boom.
The Trump administration has cut back many Obama-era environmental protections. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Developing economies could face disruption from the shockwaves of Britain crashing out of the European Union with no deal. Analysts say while Europe will be hit the hardest by a no-deal Brexit, the effects on global trading routes and supply chains could have consequences far beyond the continent. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Brexit will affect not only Britain's relations with the European Union, but also with hundreds of other countries with which Britain currently trades on EU terms. London has negotiated new post-Brexit trade arrangements with several countries, including Central American nations, Switzerland and South Korea, among others. But that leaves hundreds of states, from smaller economies to relative giants like Japan and Canada, with whom trade would revert to World Trade Organization terms after a no-deal Brexit. And striking new trade deals won't be easy.
Many countries with whom we try and do trade deals will say to us, yep, that would be great. We'd quite like to know what your relationship with the European Union is going to be before we sign anything with you, though. So all roads lead to Brussels.
Such uncertainty doesn't help countries that sell goods to Britain. Kenya exports cut flowers, fruit and vegetables, with total exports to Britain estimated at $400 million per year. Bangladesh exports almost $4 billion worth of goods to Britain, currently traded under the EU's preferential rules of origin, which allocate zero or low tariffs on goods from developing countries. A no-deal Brexit will likely mean disruption.
The problem is that will erode the preferences that some of these countries receive. So, for example, the advantage that a country such as Bangladesh and Cambodia have on certain products, because they have access with a lower tariff, that would be removed.
Speaking last month, the head of the Africa Development Bank warned that the combination of a no-deal Brexit and the US-China trade war were hitting African economies.
The industrial capacity has fallen significantly, and so the demand, even for products and raw materials from Africa, will only fall even further. So the effect of that could have a ripple effect on African economies as the demand for their products weakens from China.
Britain, meanwhile, is stepping up its search for new trade deals, with ministers visiting New Zealand, Australia and Japan this week. Many of these nations' companies have huge investments in Britain and fear the chaotic fallout of a no-deal Brexit. Overall, for smaller economies, the impact is likely to be less severe.
African countries seem to be quite more relaxed, or developing countries more relaxed, except some specific countries that trade a lot with the UK. about the prospect of a no deal. And this is because, well, the UK has lost over many years the sort of importance in the as a destination of exports for many of these countries.
A no deal Brexit would hit the economies of many EU states like Ireland, Germany and the Netherlands. But analysts say it is in Britain where the impact will inevitably be felt hardest of all. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Kenya has exported its first shipment of oil under a deal with the Chinese petrochemical company ChemChina, worth $12 million. Members of civil society under the umbrella Kenya Civil Society Platform on Oil and Gas are demanding transparency, calling on the Kenyan government to show how the Chinese firm won the bid to buy the oil and how much revenue the country is getting from the sale. The group warns of conflict if the government continues to keep the oil deals secret.
After years of exploration, Kenya exported its first crude oil shipment last month. Amid the excitement of Kenya joining the list of oil-producing countries, some civil society groups are accusing the government of keeping oil deals with the Chinese company secret. Charles Wanguhu is a coordinator of Kenya's Civil Society Platform on Oil and Gas, a lobby group that works around the issues of oil and gas. He says they want to know whether the country is getting the best deal for its resource.
The challenge that's ongoing in the sector is a lack of proper disclosure. So the ministry indicated that there was a bidding process for the oil, but we have not had access to any of the bidding documents, for example, or which are the companies that actually bid for the oil, how much do they bid for the oil, so that by the time they got ChemChina, which was the eventual buyer of the oil, we were asking for a more transparent process of this bidding so that you could actually say that the country's actually got the best deal.
Kenya's Principal Secretary of Petroleum, Andrew Kamau, says the information the government provided on who bought the oil and how much they paid was enough.
It's not a fair comment. We told them who bought it, how much they paid for it, and the volume. What more would you want? People have all sorts of phobias, so, you know, can't really speak to that.
The ministry was also reluctant to share how much was spent in the oil exploration. China has helped Kenya to build roads and standard gauge railway line running into millions of dollars. Wanguhu says he fears for the future if China will be the primary oil buyer from Kenya.
The challenge is that we have a significant amount of debt that's been accrued to China in the building of infrastructure, for example, around the SGR. And so it's significant when you see that, if our oil is going to China, then the risk falls that if we are unable to service our debts, that we might get into an agreement that might not be suitable for the country.
Helen Odegi, an oil and gas expert, says history does not favor Kenya when it comes to managing public resources.
The side I would be worried about is because of the history we have in Kenya of misuse of resources, so that we don't find ourselves facing another issue like what we've seen in the past few, let's say 2-3 years, of massive amounts of money being lost in the counties and even in the national government, so that we don't make money and then it's going to the pockets of one or two companies only.
Kenya currently produces about 2,000 barrels of oil per day. Last month, oil explorer Tulo said that production could rise to 100,000 barrels per day by 2024. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Homelessness has risen 12% in Los Angeles since last year, despite more spending than ever on housing assistance. And experts say high rents are just pushing even more people out of the housing market. Mike O'Sullivan reports it's a problem faced by many cities around the world that can result in permanent pockets of urban poverty.
It's a common sight in Los Angeles, thousands of people living in tents on the street. These are budding shanty towns, says one analyst, like those in developing countries.
What you're seeing now is the first signs of a drift in this structural direction, because you're seeing tent cities.
This despite some progress. Los Angeles moved more than 21,000 people from the streets to permanent housing last year, funded by two measures approved by voters. Some solutions are short-term, including a 45-bed shelter where this man found refuge.
The rents are too high here in L.A., and it's very hard. I can't do it myself. I need help, So I thank God that they brought the shelter here.
Set up with help from the city, this shelter was the first of many that offer hope to those lucky enough to get in.
The fact that they can kind of put their heads down at night and be able to sleep and feel like they're safe and secure where they are versus having to be up all night, worrying about like whether they're going to be attacked on the streets.
Substance abuse and mental illness can contribute, but high rents and low incomes are the root cause, says a local official who is tackling the problem.
Los Angeles is the least affordable housing market in the United States. We have underbuilt housing for decades, unfortunately. That's something we have in common with the rest of California.
Sprawling western U.S. cities were built for long commutes and low-density housing.
And this model works very well until you run out of space for new highways. And the result is that you push people further and further out of the center. It becomes more and more expensive to live in the center near where the jobs are.
A strong urban economy has left many behind.
If we invested more in prevention, if we had more available affordable housing so people had choices in their housing options, we wouldn't see people who are living right on the edge. As soon as something catastrophic happens in their life, they get pushed over the edge and they end up on the streets.
The Trump administration says nearly half of the nation's unsheltered homeless live in California and calls for deregulation of the housing market, including zoning and, more controversially, rent controls and environmental mandates. Experts say that every level of government needs to figure out ways to spur construction of affordable housing. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, rapper Nicki Minaj is about to release a hot new album. This just 2 weeks after announcing she was retiring. In an interview with Elle magazine for its upcoming October issue, she talked about her new project, saying it was the most excited she has been in a long time. Minaj has apologized for her abrupt retirement announcement, but has not taken back that she may do it. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Shorty's a mega con. It ain't about the race either, it's the marathon. I put the squeeze on him, don't go with the bees on him. That they're clapping on the dirty Hercules on him. My name is Baddie Baddie.
This is VOA News.